Well, this morning we are, as I mentioned already, that we're ending our sermon series on the book of Genesis. And there's a whole bunch of pens up here. We're ending our sermon series on the book of Genesis, and we've gone through, and one of the reasons that we study the book of Genesis is because it's the origins, it's the beginning, and it helps us to understand the story of God more fully. It helps us to understand not only the nature of God's identity, but it helps us to understand the nature of our identity as well. And so this morning we're going to end with a passage about Joseph. And last week, Crystal talked a fair amount about the story of Joseph. And we're going to talk about the very end of that story in Genesis chapter 50. So why don't we begin by reading this text, and then we'll go ahead and talk about it. We're going to read chapter 50, verses 15 to 21. You should be able to follow along in your bulletin if you'd like. Starting at verse 15, it says, "When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, 'What if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him?' So they sent word to Joseph, saying, 'Your father left these instructions before he died. This is what you are to say to Joseph: I ask you to forgive your brothers and the sins and the wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. So please forgive the sins of the servants of the God of your father.' When their message came to him, Joseph wept. His brothers then came and threw themselves down before him. 'We are your slaves,' they said. But Joseph said to them, 'Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children.' And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them." This morning we end this book of Genesis with a theme that is pervasive throughout the entire Bible, and it's fundamental to who we believe we are as Christians. It's the theme of forgiveness. And normally when we talk about forgiveness, what we really like to talk about is the forgiveness that God has for us. Or we really like to talk, perhaps at the next level, of asking other people for forgiveness. But something that is extremely difficult for us as people, as human beings, is to forgive other people that have harmed us. And that's the aspect of forgiveness that I particularly want us to think about. And during, now that I've said this several times, I've given you several opportunities to do some reflection on who these people may be in your life, what events may have harmed you or caused you to suffer, and that you still maintain thoughts and feelings that arouse right when you begin to think about these people or these events. And as we talk about this passage, as we talk about forgiveness, I want you to keep those people in mind. All of us have suffered at some level, at some point in our lives. All of us have stories of frustration, of anger, of holding grudges. And this morning, I want us to think about how we can move forward in those relationships. And I think this story of Joseph is a good place, a good way to do that. Last week, Crystal shared a lot of the story of Joseph, so I'm not going to rehash the whole story that happened to him. But what's really applicable for our passage this week is that what happened to Joseph early on in his life is, if you remember, as Crystal talked about last week, he had this fancy coat that, if you just saw the play, you know about. He has this fancy coat, and it makes his brothers jealous of him. They're jealous of all that Joseph says about himself. They're jealous of the favor that their father gives to Joseph. And so all his brothers, all these guys get together, and they devise the scheme by which they're going to cause Joseph a great deal of harm. And so they basically fake like they have killed him. They let his father know that he's dead, and what they actually do is they sell him into slavery. So Joseph is sold into slavery by his brothers. And as Crystal talked about last week, there's this big, long story of all that happens. And Joseph eventually rises to a place of power in Egypt. And all his brothers find out. They go, and they don't know it's Joseph. And then they find out it's Joseph. They find out he's at this place of power. But then when we arrive at this passage, the passage that we read this morning, it begins with this question. Jacob, the father of all these boys, has died. And the brothers at the beginning of our passage immediately begin to wonder this fundamental question that they ask in verse 15. "What if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him?" What if our brother Joseph holds a grudge against us, and because of all the power and authority he now has, pays us back for all the harm that we have done to him. What a perfectly reasonable question. We talk about sometimes an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth. This idea that if someone wrongs us, then we ought to have the right or we ought to be entitled to give them just a taste, just a piece of the harm, the suffering, the pain, all it is that they've caused us. And it's natural to us. Every one of us has that instinct in us to want to do that. There's a part of us that cries out to do that. A few weeks ago, remember, we talked about the story of Esau and his brother, and that Esau stole his brother stole Esau's blessing away from him, and the passage says that Esau hated his brother. The other thing it says, it uses this exact language, is that Esau held a grudge against him. Same thing that's happening here, the same fear that Joseph's brothers have. Will Joseph hold a grudge against us? We all have all sorts of reasons, good reasons, to hold grudges against other people. All of us have suffered in some way. We've all been hurt. We've all been scarred. Some of us have been abused or betrayed or ridiculed or embarrassed or harassed or lied to. And as those things happen, we feel a great deal of pain and suffering and hurt. A book I read a few years ago, actually one of the best books I've ever read on forgiveness, was the story of a woman who grew up in the 50s and 60s, an African-American woman who grew up in the 50s and 60s and was subject to just massive amounts of racism. And this book, it's called My First White Friend, and it is about her struggle to move from hatred of all that happened to her and the situations that she faced, and really her hatred towards white people that she encountered, and how she moved from this place of hatred to this place of overwhelming forgiveness. And as you read her story, there are few people in the world that have as much evidence and reasons and justification for hate than her, based upon the things that happened to her and the stories of things that she was subjected to. And all of us have some level of this hate in us. And I want to read just some of her words at the very beginning of the book, what she says. She says, "White people as a category embodied, in my view, a clear and certain evil, an arrogant malevolence that had done unspeakable things that I couldn't ignore because I knew the facts of these things, names and dates and numbers. And the facts haunted me, and the numbers justified my hate for all the evil that I believed white people had done. I knew the stories. I had heard them in childhood, at the knees of people I loved, in the presence of people I trusted. Terrible stories. Horror stories. I hated white people for all of it. So for the pain of these things and for the hurt of these things, for declaring black and brown and red and yellow a terrible thing to be, and having the power to enforce that belief, I hated them and I hated their ways, even their means and their deeds. Their grandfather clause and their Virginia Code and their Dred Scott Rule and their Group Areas Act and their Plessy Doctrine and their poll taxes and their past laws and every other word or deed or intent that they devised to shackle the lives and prayers of defenseless people. I hated them good and I hated them hard. A grotesque, that was me." And it sounds like really harsh language. I mean, it sounds just so venomous. And what's so powerful about this book is that I think that at some level, all of us have had these feelings. We just don't admit them. And what's powerful about this book is how well she can describe where she was at. And what's even more amazing is where she gets. And all of us, again, have these feelings deep within inside of us. And we may have different objects of our hate, our anger, and our frustration. We likely have different objects. But we all can relate at some level with that, whether we admit it or not. She says, "A grotesque, that was me." She recognizes how broken and wrong and frustrating her reaction to what has happened to her is. And she goes on to say that this pain and this suffering actually propelled her to do great things. That because of her anger and her frustration, it drove her to get straight A's. It drove her to be well accomplished and to go to college and to get advanced degrees and to always have people like her and to try to please the people around her. And our hate often does that. I mean, think about the things that we do. I despise my ex, so I want to prove to him or her how great my new family is. I hate my parents, so I'm going to show them that I don't even need them. I can stand up on my own power. I can accomplish things without their help at all. I loathe my coworkers, so I'm going to outdream them. I'm going to out-accomplish them. I'm going to do better work than them. So this frustration, this hate, this suffering that we have, this grudge against other people, can sometimes be turned to a good thing, a motivating factor. But it doesn't change the condition of the heart that leads to it. The brokenness that is at its root. And Joseph's brothers fully understand this brokenness that is common amongst human beings. And so when they go and they know what they have done to Joseph and they can admit their failure, they fully expect and they know that he has every right to, every justification to come back to them and cause them the same amount of harm that they have caused him. He has the authority, he has the power, and to be honest, they deserve it. They deserve it because of what they did. Joseph does not, however. And that's why this passage becomes so powerful, that Joseph does not take advantage. And what we'll find is that Joseph doesn't learn this lesson immediately. If we read all these chapters before we get to this passage, you know that Joseph plays around with his brothers. They come and he pretends that he doesn't know them, and he leads them on this wild goose chase back to their homeland. And he does. He plays around with them. And one of the things we're going to talk about is that forgiveness is a process. It's not something where you just flip the light switch and all of a sudden you feel completely different towards someone. It doesn't work that way. And it didn't for Joseph. But what we find is that instead of giving his brothers retribution that they likely deserve, Joseph chooses instead a higher ground, which is the way of love and which is the way of forgiveness. So what does it mean to forgive someone? Well, in verse 19, Joseph gets us close. He says, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? Am I in the place of God?" And then Joseph goes on to explain that though what has happened to them, that happened to him, caused a great deal of harm, he doesn't hold it against them, and he doesn't have any desire to harm them, because God has taken what was harmful to him, what is harmful to Joseph, and has used it for good. That God's plans, God's desires were greater than these single actions that the brothers did against Joseph. And Joseph sees that. One translation of verse 19 says, "You need have not fear of retribution, for I have God's view of things, and therefore am above retaliation." I have God's view of things, and therefore am above retaliation. So forgiveness, at a very basic level, if we are to define it, forgiveness is giving up our right to hurt someone because they have hurt us. Forgiveness is giving up our right to hurt someone because they have caused some harm, some suffering, some pain, some hurt against us. And this definition is really important for us. Because when we have been hurt and when we suffer, everything in us cries out to do the opposite of this. I mean, think about how our kids interact with one another. If Miriam hits Adelaide, her first instinct is to hit her back. I mean, without even thinking, if someone causes us some harm, our immediate instinct is to desire, even if we don't act on it, our desire is for them to experience, to see just how much we hurt, to experience it themselves. But to forgive is to wipe the slate clean, to pardon them, to cancel the debt that we imagine that they owe us, or that they actually do owe us because of what they've done. And what is essential for us to understand is that forgiveness is not given because the other person has earned it or deserve it. that forgiveness, as the Bible understands it, is grace, it is mercy, and it is love. And this is going to be fundamental to how we understand forgiveness. It is not dependent upon the person that hurt us or harmed us. It is not dependent at all upon the person that harmed us or hurt us. Forgiveness is an act of love, it is an act of grace, an act of mercy. This steps forward even if the other person has not confessed, is not repentant, is still doing hurtful and harmful things. It is a step that we take. Everyone suffers. Everyone. Everyone is hurt and put in pain and suffering at some point in their life. And so the question isn't whether we're going to have these things happen to us or we're going to have instances where we want to hold a grudge against someone else. The question for us as faithful people seeking to follow God is when these things happen, when pain and suffering happen to us, what is it that we do with it? What is our reaction that happens next? Other people are not an excuse for us not to love. We still, ultimately, because God has given us this ability, have the choice, the ability to do something. One really extraordinary example of this is a guy named Viktor Frankl. Viktor Frankl was an Austrian, he was Jewish, he was Austrian, he was a physician that survived the Holocaust. And again, he tells an amazing story of his process of forgiveness and how he was able to move forward in love. Speaking about how everyone has the choice of how to respond to suffering, he said, "In the concentration camps, in that living laboratory, we saw some of our comrades behaving like pigs and others behaving like saints. Both alternatives are hidden in a person, and which will be realized depends on decisions and not on conditions." That people that were enduring great suffering and hardship, all in the same place, enduring the very same things, had radically different responses in how they handled it. And he goes on to tell that when he was brought to Auschwitz, he was taken to the showers after being selected to live. His manuscripts of all his scientific work, his life's work, was taken from him and thrown into the fire. At that moment, he felt that his personality was being erased, totally disintegrated and smashed into smithereens. This sensation redoubled when he left the showers, having had his hair shaved and deloused. Everyone appeared shaven and broken as though they had undergone a total metamorphosis of personality. After receiving his clothes, and the Germans made sure that short, thin people received long, wide clothes, and that tall, broad people received short, narrow clothes as a part of the attempt to grind down their personality and turn the individual into a ridiculous automation, Frankl put his hand in the pocket of his jacket and found a piece of paper. It was a legacy from the former owner of the garment, who had been separated from his clothes before separating from the world in the gas chambers. This piece of paper was the page of a prayer book which bore the verse, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." In that second, he says his perception of his personality came back to him. And this is the Shema. It's the famous passage that the Jews often recite out of Deuteronomy. And it's this recognition that at the core of who we were created to be, at the core of who we are, God created us in His image, and that God is one, that there is one God, and that our very identity is in that God. And Frankl recognized that no matter what anyone could do to him in any of those concentration camps, no matter how much hatred, no matter how much suffering, no matter how much pain was inflicted on him, no one could take away the essential nature of God and His relationship with God. And that relationship with God changed his view of not only the people that he interacted with, but how he was able to move forward and not backwards in a life of holding a grudge. This is the point. Forgiveness is all not at all dependent upon the person that has caused us to suffer. They may be dead. They may no longer be alive. They may still be breathing out hatred and venom. They may have not changed one bit. Our forgiveness is not dependent upon them. Because within us, by the Spirit of God, by a relationship with God, by the nature of our God being a God of love, we have the power. They don't have the power. We have the power. And they cannot take away our choice to love. They cannot take away the Spirit of God that resides within us. You know, there are few forces in our world more powerful than forgiveness. And I mean that. Our world tends to think that that is weak, right? That it is a very weak thing when someone harms us and causes us pain to forgive them and to move forward. It's a weak thing. A powerful thing is to pummel them, right? To cause just as much suffering to them. But forgiveness is completely disarming. Completely disarming. It's one of the most aggressive acts that we can do as faithful people. To say, you have no power over me. I'm autonomous from you and from your influence. And I can choose to do what it is that I choose to do. So how do we get there? How do we forgive those that have wronged us? Joseph follows this process fairly clearly. The first thing is fairly obvious. The first one is that we must recognize the pain and the suffering and the hurt that we have. We have to sit in it. We have to know it. We have to name it. That we have to understand the depths of the pain and suffering that someone else has caused us. And it's okay to think about that. It's okay to pray about that. It's okay to reflect on that. Because until we fully understand how wrong and how real and how hurtful it was, we can't move forward. So the first thing is, how did we get here? How did this happen to us? The second thing, though, is once we've recognized what has happened to us, we have to move to a place where it no longer controls us. That it doesn't cause this cause and effect reaction, that when we dwell on this hurt and pain, it instantly causes us to seek retribution. We have to move from this place of being a victim to being someone that's in control. Because the thing about being in a place of being a victim is that all you're thinking about is that other person. That all you're thinking about is the hurt and the pain that's happened, and you get stuck there. And in a sense, it actually becomes your identity. In the book that I've talked about, in the book My First White Friend, Patricia Rayburn, she talks about this. She says that she built an identity around that suffering and that pain and that hatred. And we do that all the time. That we imagine that is who we are. That is a part of the effect of what has happened to us. A powerful example, though, of how we move beyond this is Jesus. And Jesus is always the perfect example for us. But imagine just exactly what happened to him. That he lives this perfect life of graciousness and love, of miracles. He is God. He was a miracle worker. And then he watches and he walks down this path through which everyone that was around him leads him to his death. And they literally pummel his body, and they crucify him on this cross, and they whip him, and they do all these horrible things to him. And in that moment, when he's on the cross, and everything that would be going through my mind, I can tell you, is how much I hate these people for what they've done. How evil they are. How awful they are. How bad they are. And if I were Jesus and had the power of God at my disposal, I would not stay on that cross. I would come down from that cross and do everything that I wanted to do to them. But Jesus, in full submission, understanding all the power that he has at his disposal, does the most aggressive thing possible. And he says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." That's crazy. "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." That's not anger. That's not hatred. That's hardly frustration. That's compassion, and that's love for people that are doing evil to him. And at first, it seems like such a submissive and weak and lack of passion thing to do. But think about how powerful that is, how aggressive that is. He is saying, you have no power over me. I am who I am. I am secure in who I am. And no matter what you do, no matter what darts you throw at me, no matter what harm and abuse you put on me, I am God. I am one with the Father. And it's the same for us. No, we're not God. But the Bible tells us that the Spirit of God is within us. And for us to look upon the hurt, the pain, the person that we hold these grudges against and say, you have no power over me. And to start to see them through a compassionate, a loving lens is a radically aggressive thing to do. It reorients our perspective. And we find that when we do this, we start to say, I am so sorry that they are so broken and they are so lost and they are so filled with hatred that they did what they did to me. And you see, it's a subtle difference, but it's a powerful difference. When Jesus tells us to love our enemies, that's how he did it. He moves to a place of seeing them through this lens of love and compassion, of seeing that at the very root of what it was that they did to him and what it is that people do to us is a deep brokenness and hurt and pain. And it saddened him. It saddened him. I think we subtly move from hoping that this person that we have a grudge against gets hit by a bus on the way out of work to hoping that they move in some positive way. Moving from hoping that those people that we're so frustrated with feel all the pain and the suffering that we have, that they lose everything, that they lose their job, and that they have some sort of ailment, all these awful things that cross our mind, all these negative things, to dreaming and hoping and yearning that they might repent and turn from what they did. We no longer wish their demise, but we truly hope that they may find life and new hope. So understand me clearly. Forgiveness does not deny our hurt. It doesn't deny our pain. It doesn't deny our suffering. That is real. You're not called to give that up. You're not called at all to pretend it didn't happen. But what forgiveness does is it puts us in a place where we can take one step and then another step to move from the control that it has over us. It is getting to a place where we can desire the other's good above our hurt. That we can desire the other's good above our hurt. I mentioned this earlier, but forgiveness does not have to be all or nothing. This is one of the stumbling blocks I think that we have for us. And if you know, for Joseph, it was a process. I mean, the first things he did weren't real noble. They were probably sinful in a lot of ways. He plays around with his brothers. He tricks them. He pretends that he's not Joseph, and he sends them on this goose chase back to their father and tells them all these things and sticks their money back in their bag. All these things that happen in the life of Joseph. Forgiveness is a process. You're not going to, if this is the first time that God's really kind of wrestled with you with some particular things that you need to forgive, I don't have any vain notions that we share this message and you read this text and then you walk out and you get in your car in the parking like, man, done there, forgave that person, never going to think about it again. It doesn't work that way. I wish it did. Maybe sometimes you've had an experience where it works that way. But 9 out of 10 times it is a process. And it's a process where you may find yourself saying, I don't know necessarily even how I got here, but now I feel like, I don't know, I've forgiven that person 5%. And I want to get to 15, and before you know it, you're at 25, and 75%. And then you reach a point in your life where you still know it. You still know it happened to you. It's an important distinction. We're talking about forgiveness. We're not talking about forgetting. You're not going to forget these things. Our minds often don't work that way. You're still going to remember the events. You're going to remember the facts. You're probably even going to remember the hurt that it caused you at the time. But in remembering that, you'll find that in forgiveness, it no longer affects you emotionally. It becomes information as opposed to something that you hold a grudge against that captures you emotionally. And so when we talk about what the Bible calls us to in forgiveness, what God is saying is take one step in the right direction. Start the process. Do not be content living in the grudge. Begin to walk towards the love that God has called us to. In our passage, Joseph says, "Am I in the place of God?" He's saying, "Am I perfect? Am I the one responsible for judgment?" He's given over the right to cause his brothers suffering or to cause them pain and saying, "It is not mine to deal with. Judgment is, I'm not responsible for that. If judgment is to come for them, then that's God's work. That's not my work." And he trusts that. And he enters back into relationship with them. You know that I'm a visual learner, and so I did some really cheesy diagrams that I want to use to help us understand what this looks like in our life. I can't draw, so I have to use stick figures. But I think this conceptually helps us to understand what happens. So this is how I understand. Someone does something to us. They cause us pain. They cause us suffering. And again, every single one of you has this happen to you. You can think of something in your life where this has happened. This is universal. We live in a sinful world. There are broken and lost people, and they will hurt us. No matter what, it's going to happen and continues to happen. So the question for us then is, what do we do with that hurt? This is what we normally do. What we normally do is we turn ourselves towards the person that has hurt us and caused us pain. And what the text tells us is we hold a grudge. We maintain some sort of right that we have. We maintain some sort of desire to hurt them or to cause pain back to them. And so whatever form that may take. As Christians, this is kind of interesting. As Christians, normally in our world, there's two things that we want to do. We want to hold a grudge, which is in our mind. We want to imagine suffering on the other person. The other thing often that people want to do is actually do that thing. You do something to get back at the person. You go and talk about them behind their back. You want to cause them some sort of pain. Now, in our faith life, what we often do is we say, okay, I'm a good Christian person. I'm not going to do retribution. I'm not going to cause them harm. I'm not going to talk about them behind their back. And then we justify ourselves in holding the grudge. And that's an important thing. We're not just talking about not doing outward actions towards this other person. We're saying, what is the condition of your heart towards them? And that's a much tougher thing to wrestle with. And so these people that I've called you to think about this very morning, when you think about them, when you think about their name and what they did to you, what are the emotions, feelings that swell up inside of you? It's often a grudge. What does forgiveness look like? Forgiveness, I believe, is a movement from the pain, the harm, and the suffering. And especially a movement from our focus on the person that has harmed us and hurt us. A recognition that we have the power, regardless of what they've done to us, to love and to put our eyes on the goal, on God, to start to move away from that, to move away from those feelings. And again, it's a process. It's small steps. And this is to be distinguished between, there's a way of distinguishing between forgiveness, which is not at all dependent upon the person that caused us harm or pain, and reconciliation, okay? They're two very different things. Reconciliation, this is how I draw reconciliation. Reconciliation is what we're hoping for, but may or may not happen. Reconciliation is when the person that harmed us and hurt us knows that they have, they repent of that, and they decide to go in the same direction as us. Okay, in the Joseph passage, this is what ultimately happens, right? That they harm Joseph, they do awful things to him. And Joseph, even before this passage, arrives at a place of forgiveness where he says, I know you've hurt me. I know you've done these awful things to me, but I am going to turn and walk away from them and to seek to love you regardless. And then at the end of the passage, in 50, what happens is that Joseph's brothers recognize the harm and the suffering and the things that they've done to Joseph. And they go to Joseph and they say, we're sorry for these things. We know we deserve for you to pummel us. And then they decide to walk off together, which is reconciliation. Reconciliation requires both parties, and it may or may not happen. It's dependent upon them. Forgiveness is solely dependent upon us. We have that power. We have that ability to give up that burden, that pain, that suffering, so that it doesn't affect us in the way that we see our world and our love. In the book that I've mentioned several times, as the author, Patricia Rayborn, moves forward in forgiveness, she says towards the end that she calls out to God. She says, God, help me. And then she says, when forgiveness sets in, you tend to feel sorry over the circumstances instead of rage. You tend to feel sorry for the person rather than angry with him. You understand the suffering that drove the offense to begin with. You are not waiting for anything. You are free, free to go. And that's the power of the gospel. That's the power of God. That's the power of Jesus Christ, is that this is a way that sets us free. Sets us free from the bondage to those scars and that pain and that suffering. And that's my prayer for us this morning, is that we begin that process of being set free, of loving fully again, of moving forward in our walk of forgiveness. Let's pray. Gracious God, we thank you for your truth. We thank you for this opportunity to enter into a community of people that are walking this journey together. Lord, help us not to compromise in saying, well, at least I don't harm other people. At least I don't cause retribution upon them. Lord, help us not to settle there, but enter into a process by which we move our hearts from holding grudges, move our hearts from desiring or hoping secretly for retribution, to a way where we can honestly and truthfully look back upon a situation as mere facts, as information, of things that happened to us that have affected us, but in ways that do not bind us, that have not bound us, so that we are truly free to step forward and move forward in our relationship with you and in our relationship with others. In all these things, we pray in your glorious name. Amen.